Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing ongoing media coverage of the worst humanitarian crisis in modern history. 8 million Syrians are still internally displaced, more than 4 million are in neighboring countries, and hundreds of thousands are risking their lives to reach Europe. A Syrian NGO worker recently told The Guardian that the Syrians have become a commodity traded and sold in the international bazaar, but no one is thinking of solving the causes of the problem. Instead, everyone is thinking about how to throw the problem on the other. So how are reporters covering such a massive tragedy? And how do they tackle that issue of solving the causes of the problem? Today, we're joined by Karim Shaheen, Middle East reporter for The Guardian based in Beirut. Hi, Karim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Roy Gutman is former Middle East bureau chief for McClatchy. Roy is currently working as a freelance journalist based in Istanbul, and this morning he joins us from Washington. Hi, Roy. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Emma Graham Harrison is international affairs correspondent with The Observer, and she's based in London. Hi, Emma. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Karim Shaheen, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
It's actually one of my colleagues in The Guardian, Patrick Kingsley, who's been covering the migrant refugee crisis for much of the last year. He's been 17 countries writing about migration issues of migration, and he wrote a very good piece about the implications of the latest deal between Turkey and the European Union, and he's got a new book that's coming out called The New Odyssey, which follows the trek of thousands of refugees fleeing conflict in the region all the way to Europe.
Well, we'll have to invite Patrick on. He wrote that piece with today's guest, Emma Graham Harrison, and we'll talk with her about that in just a couple of minutes. So kudos to Patrick Kinsley of The Guardian. Thank you for that. And what about you, Roy? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
The New York Times carried the content of a speech that Yang Jiesheng, who's a Chinese journalist, was supposed to give at Harvard, except that he was prohibited from leaving China to go. It's at the Nieman Foundation. And he's a very gutsy reporter himself. He's now become a history writer because he can't do reporting anymore. Anyway, so they ran the contents of what he was going to say at the Nieman Foundation. Maybe I'll just give you a quote because it sort of gives a kind of a model for what reporters really should be. He said, "Reporters should ask for nothing and fear nothing, position yourself between heaven and earth. By asking nothing, I mean not hoping for promotion or wealth. By fearing nothing, I mean examining one's own behavior and not exposing a pigtail for anyone to grab. Don't rely on the powerful, but rather on your own character and professional independence." And the line I love the most is "not exposing a pigtail for anyone to grab." But this is one great reporter who, in a way, is a model for every one of us.
Wow, that's amazing. We sure could use more of that with election coverage. Well, I'd love to read that. Looking forward to it. So kudos to the New York Times for writing this and getting their hands on the speech that was supposed to be given at Harvard.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for that. And that's Roy Gutman. What about you, Emma? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, actually, I've also spent a lot of time reporting from China, and I was going to mention Yang Jiesheng's speech, which you can actually just find on the Nieman Harvard website in its entirety, which I recommend. Although I'm sure the New York Times did a great job, I recommend just going to the original so you can read his words, which have been really beautifully translated by Stacey Mosher.
All right, so we will put links to those stories at yourcallradio.org. Emma Graham Harrison is international affairs correspondent with The Observer. Roy Gutman is an independent journalist, freelance journalist, former Middle East bureau chief with McClatchy. And Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian. And Emma, I want to start off with you because I know you have to leave us in 10 minutes. You wrote a piece with your colleagues Patrick Kingsley and Gaith Abdul Ahad And the piece is called We Will Find a Way, Syrian Refugees React to Planned EU-Turkey Deal. Syrian refugees, as you report, have reacted with defiance and confusion to the proposed EU-Turkey deal that would see asylum seekers returned to Turkey after arriving in Greece. Just briefly, how is this going to work?
Well, I think one of the things that's confusing people about this deal is that it doesn't really seem to make a great deal of sense. It seems to offer a perverse incentive because, as it has been presented, for every refugee who arrives in Europe and is returned to Turkey, another one will be settled in Europe, which sort of seems to imply there's an incentive for people to still keep attempting to reach Europe illegally. And I think it's what we were sort of looking at with that article and a question I think Europe's leaders haven't really addressed is that the crisis that Europe's dealing with was not sort of created by the policies or the decisions of last summer. You know, the decision to open some of those European borders was a response to a crisis that was already building up. I mean, particularly, I think there was a lot of moral pressure for change after 71 refugees, most of them Syrians, were found dead in a truck. They'd suffocated to death in this refrigerated truck trying to cross borders illegally. So, you know, you had people attempting to make that journey to a place where they felt they could rebuild a life for themselves, for their children, at great, great risk to themselves. And there's no reason to think that, you know, even if Europe makes it harder again, that people are going to stop risking their lives in that endeavor. They're already risking their lives to go to sea. They're obviously prepared to take these terrible gambles because they feel so desperate.
And Roy, you have also been writing about this. You've got a piece for Politico's Europe edition called What's Behind EU-Turkey Alliance of Convenience. You write that Ankara refuses to be Europe's, quote, junkyard for migrants, but eagerly wants Merkel's support.
Yeah, I think the whole refugee and migration crisis that developed this past year came as a surprise to nearly everybody. I mean, you know, the refugees have been building up in Turkey since 2011. There's now 2.7 million registered, and then there's the unregistered who released several hundred thousand. It's an immense number. And then you have the same thing in Jordan. You have the same thing in Lebanon. And basically, all these countries have now closed their doors to more refugees coming in from Syria. And the real reason is they're getting under pressure from Europe, which doesn't want illegals coming in by boat, and probably doesn't want them to coming in at all. But I think the European leaders, certainly the responsible ones, agree that something has to be done for refugees from a country that's now coming apart, whose leader, Bashar Assad, seems to want to destroy the country by whatever means he has to and expel the population, at least the population that doesn't support him. So you have a country coming apart and generating an immense flood of people. The unregulated illegal outflow from Turkey is something that the Turks just allowed to develop, but I think it also just it happened on its own, and they didn't react until the Europeans forced them to. What's coming out of this summit this last Monday, it may not be a very positive and a happy outcome, but it's at least a way of trying to regulate it, and the idea is that the European countries will take refugees, you know, in an orderly way by airplane from Istanbul or Gaziantep or somewhere else, and Turkey will stop the illegal outflow via these little fragile dinghies that often come apart and drown at least a dozen people almost every day. Not a good outcome, but I think it's preferable, and I think the Europeans have to have it, and the Turks I think are willing to make the deal because they don't want to see Europe come apart either.
A dozen people are drowning every day.
You know, it's a stunning number. There are hundreds per month. Yes.
Emma, this deal has been called by some commentators as illegal and immoral. What are your thoughts about how this deal is being covered?
I think, you know, the point we've just heard is true that you know, the search for a way to resettle people without them having to take that terrible risk, that terrible sea journey, is a positive one. And in that sense, you know, efforts to dissuade people from doing that and offer them another alternative is a positive thing. I think the problem is there's a very basic principle of international law about returning refugees. And I think there's a lot of concerns that by returning refugees to Turkey without checking that there's guarantees for their safety, for their future, for their status there, that you're possibly violating some of those laws. And as I say, as I understand the deal at the moment, what they're saying is that, you know, for each person who reaches Europe via the sea route and is sent back, another refugee will be allowed to settle in Europe. But you still then have a very perverse incentive for people to still risk their lives. And just to give you an idea of the death total from the latest from the UN, during the first 6 weeks of 2016, 410 people drowned crossing the Eastern Mediterranean.
Mm. And Emma, I know we have to let you go in a few minutes. What do you think about what the Syrian NGO worker told The Guardian, that no one is thinking of solving the causes of the problem? As a reporter, how do you go about tackling that issue?
Well, I think, you know, one of the limitations of being a journalist is that you are ultimately just an observer. You know, you can try and illuminate issues for other people to act and comment on what they're doing if you're an opinion writer. But, you know, ultimately you're not the person who's taking any of these decisions. So, I mean, I think as a journalist you have to just try and make your coverage as comprehensive and as balanced as possible, and perhaps try and make sure that people, you know, focus back on why people are leaving their homes, why people are leaving, in some cases leaving their families behind, leaving everything they've known for very, very insecure, you know, difficult lives, either in refugee camps, you know, risking their lives trying to reach Europe, and, you know, even when they reach Europe, you know, living in a foreign land, often where their qualifications are not worth anything, people who've had very secure, comfortable lives having to start absolutely all over again. So, you know, I think part of what, you know, is important in the journalism around the crisis is, you know, keeping that focus on what's happening in Syria and why people are leaving.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show. Sorry, I've got to go.
That's okay. Thank you. That is Emma Graham Harrison. She is international affairs correspondent with The Observer, and she has a piece with colleagues, "We Will Find a Way, Syrian Refugees React to Planned EU-Turkey Deal." Roy Gutmann is Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy, former Bureau Chief. We'll talk to him about McClatchy shutting down their foreign bureaus later in the show. Roy is currently working as a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian, based in Beirut. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. This issue is getting a lot of attention. What do you think about the reporting on the immigration crisis and actual solutions to solving the causes of this problem? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Karim, there obviously have been so many stories about why people are leaving, but one of your latest is just heartbreaking, called "Syrians Under Siege. We Have No Children Anymore, Only Small Adults." And you are writing about a report by Save the Children that found sick children dying as life-saving medicine waits at checkpoints in Syria, youngsters forced to survive on animal feed and leaves, families burning their mattresses just to find something to keep them warm. Can you talk about reporting on the human side of the story and then looking at these reports, for example, by Save the Children?
Absolutely. I mean, the Save the Children report kind of meshes with a lot of the a lot of what we've been gathering from either refugees or from people who are on the ground in Syria, especially given the reporting over the last couple of months on the starvation sieges that the Assad regime had imposed on a number of towns and villages in throughout Syria as a weapon of war, and you know, it's honestly, these are the hardest stories to do, because you know, it's not a straightforward news story. It's not one that you just, you know, can kind of, you know, feel a bit disconnected from it. But you're actually talking to someone who's starving, you know. I mean, I remember when we were doing the Madaya stories, Madaya is a village near the Lebanese border that was under siege by the government, and where people were eating, you know, leaves and water flavored with spices instead of food, and you know, children were running to you know, surrounding farmland that was littered with mines in order to gather grass to cook at home. And you know, while actually talking to the people who are you know, who are actually, you know, starving, you can actually hear the hunger in their voice. You know, you can hear the exhaustion, you can hear how tired they are from having nothing to eat for so long. And it's one of the hardest things. And I've never really seen anything like it. Was talking to people who were enduring that sort of misery. You could actually hear in their voice how weak they've become. You know, and how one of them said that you know, when the aid went in, they decided to cook this you know, this feast of basically canned beans and rice, and he was saying, you know, we decided that you know, for once we're going to be full, and it's so it's always really heartbreaking to kind of you know, follow these stories and to you know, speak with people, the people behind these stories. But it's they're the ones that really illustrate you know, a crisis that's for a very long time had become about you know, numbers, and it's really easy to lose sense of these individuals by looking at the numbers. You know, tell you like 300,000 to 470. We had a story about, you know, on the anniversary of the crisis that said that between 300,000 people and 470,000 people have died in the conflict, and it's really difficult to comprehend these numbers. And obviously, there's such a large variation in the actual estimates that we risk losing sense of the actual human beings who are suffering.
Right, and so you have that, the numbers and the reports, for example, and then you have the politics, which also takes away from the human suffering.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, you're kind of following this news story that where, you know, the like, for example, this story about you know, the deal that was reached between Turkey and the EU. You know, over here in the region, it was seen as extremely dehumanizing of the plight of refugees. You know, when you kind of sit and consider the idea that, you know, these human beings are being treated like cattle. So one person is going to go, so you're going to turn them back, and then bring another one into Europe. I mean, it sounds grotesque from you know, just simply following the reporting on it. But you know, but it applies to so many other elements of the conflict. I mean, you know, we. In Beirut, for example, you know, it's very easy to see, you know, just how badly the plight of refugees has taken a toll on them, because you actually see in the street, you know, dozens of street children. When you're out at night in Beirut on a weekend, you know, there are dozens of children who are coming to, you know, sell flowers and shine shoes, and, you know, they sleep out in the street, and mothers who are with their children sitting in street corners and begging for money. And if you drive through the agricultural areas, you know, you see dozens of tent settlements and camps where people are living, you know, where it rains and floods all the time. And, you know, you can see the actual human impact of the crisis. And so, you know, it grates a lot more when you sit and read about, you know, how these, you know, there are various politics, political issues that are going on in the background, and you know, they seem so remote when you see this sort of suffering on the ground.
Roy, how do you go about tackling such a massive story with so many different elements?
Well, it's a full-time job. In fact, it's more than a full-time job. And I think, as Karim made it clear, we're all overwhelmed by it all the time. And you try to find the angles where you can actually shed some light or maybe define the story or maybe find the story that you didn't know about. You know, one of the biggest elements of the story is something that nobody even writes about now, which is that Russia is, you know, the major player right now in the war in Syria. And, you know, it started last September 30th, and they've been bombing the bejesus out of the country and claiming to be bombing and legitimizing themselves by saying they're bombing the Islamic State, the extremist group. But as a matter of fact, they're bombing civilians, and they are forcing an immense displacement. So to come to your question, you know, and go back to some of Karim's points about the numbers, you know, the numbers of people displaced since the Russians started bombing is staggering. I just saw the figure that UNHCR, the High Commission for Refugees, put out about 150,000 being displaced, I think, since the beginning of this year. But the real number may be a lot higher than that, because the UN has a very hard time with numbers. In fact, many of their numbers, including death tolls and displacement inside the country, are way low, way below the reality. And so I'm aware of that as I'm writing a story, and I try always to shed some doubt or offer some doubt about the numbers as being much too low. But even that doesn't, you know, how many readers are going to be moved by that? So the only way to really tell the story of displacement, and I mean, displacement is what leads to people fleeing and becoming refugees, and then becoming, you know, say moving to Turkey or one of the other neighboring countries, and then if they don't find work and there really isn't much work for them in Turkey, that's when they flee to Europe. Well, the way to I think one can tell the story of displacement is through the eyes and mind of one of the displaced. Mm-hmm. And I had the luck a couple of weeks ago, and I wrote a piece for The Nation about a family that had been living in Hraytan, which is very close to Aleppo, and was forced after about 3 days of Russian bombing to flee to a small village in the north of Aleppo province, which it wasn't that far away, maybe 50 kilometers or 30 miles. But it was their exodus from their own home in the middle of Hraytan to a place where they were one family of about six in one house, in fact. And the man of the family told me the story of why they had to flee. He said his wife was lying on the floor. She couldn't get up. She was so afraid. The children would say to him every day, Daddy, are we going to die? If we will die if we stay here. So he didn't even have a car. But one of his neighbors was fleeing with a small pickup truck, and so he loaded the family with just like, I guess, one suitcase each into the pickup truck, and they moved to this new location. Now, I've been in touch with him since then as well. He happens to be, luckily for me, he's an English teacher, and he's a brilliant observer. And I've talked to him regularly. I mean, I really care for this family now personally, and their fate. And he was the one who also told me about some of the bombings of in the area where he now lives, and so he's sort of watching the news very closely, and so he becomes a source for me. And I really think that's the only thing we can do is to try to tell it through the eyes of one family. But as I say, I mean, how many people have been displaced? We don't even know the numbers. Mm. How many people, even in the last few months, how many people are displaced altogether? It may be 1.5 or twice as many as the times of what the UN is telling us. So I think that's the only thing we can do. And I think also, as Karim was saying, you know, you do it through the eyes of one through the mouth of one speaker or two speakers, and you tell it in the most human way you can. Can I mention one thing just about that Emma alluded to earlier? Also,
sure.
She was saying that one of the problems with the European Turkish agreement is that it seems to break the Refugee Convention, which has this fundamental principle of what they call non-refoulement, which is non-return of refugees certainly to the country that they come from if they're in life danger. Some of these provisions are you know, and these are really good provisions. These go back to the Refugee Convention, which came out, I think, in 1949 or 1950, you know, the early 50s. But the thing is that when they leave Turkey, they're not actually leaving a country where there's war, at least not in that part of the country. There is war in Turkey, but in another part of the country. And they themselves are not really in life danger in Turkey, to the best of my knowledge. And I try to keep my eyes open for what happens to refugees. They are leaving, and many of them, in fact, for a while, and Kalim may know about this, many people were coming from Syria into Lebanon and then transiting to Turkey en route to taking a dinghy across the Aegean. And these were people who actually were not in life danger at all, but who just had given up on Syria. And in a sense, they were migrants rather than refugees. And the fact is that there's a question about whether it's safe in Turkey. I think it's relatively safe, so I don't really see that as a violation of the Refugee Convention. What I do see as an outright violation of the Refugee Convention is what's happening in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan right now, which is that all these countries, knowing that people are in life danger inside of Syria, all these countries have closed their borders to more refugees. And you know, they're like, there's 30,000 or 40,000 people at the border of Jordan right now, and they're not being allowed into the country. Lebanon has been very nasty to any new refugees coming in from Syria, and Turkey basically for the last year, but certainly in the last months, also has closed its border. Those are really outright violations of the Refugee Convention.
Roy Gutman is former Middle East Bureau Chief with McClatchy. He is currently working as a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter for The Guardian based in Beirut. And after the break, we will talk about media coverage of the UN-brokered ceasefire. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. She'll be talking with Robin Chase, the co-founder of Zipcar, and Sarah Shar, founder of Kango. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Ellen Malcolm, founder of Emily's List. She's out with a new book called Win, Women, Win. She writes about women who were not taken seriously as political candidates. Emily's List aimed to change that. There are more women in politics today than there were 30 years ago, but they still hold only 20% of the seats in the House and the Senate. So why has progress been so slow? What happens when more women get elected? We're also putting shows together next week about the safety of our water. Obviously, this is a huge issue. And we're going to do a show about the new documentary Trapped, which takes a look at anti-abortion laws. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are discussing ongoing media coverage of the worst humanitarian crisis in modern history. 8 million Syrians are internally displaced, 4 million are in neighboring countries, hundreds of thousands are risking their lives to reach Europe, and as we've heard, about a dozen people are drowning every day. Today we're joined by Karim Shaheen, Middle East reporter with The Guardian based in Beirut. Roy Gutman is former Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy. He's currently working as a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. And if you would like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Karim, we were talking about Russians' involvement and Russian bombing. How is this being covered in the Arab world?
Well, I mean, it's covered from a geopolitical perspective primarily, in the sense that there's a lot of talk about how the Russian intervention has essentially saved the Assad regime or turned the momentum of the fighting to a great extent. And then, you know, beyond that, obviously there's a lot of coverage of the humanitarian fallout from the crisis, and the battle for Aleppo in particular has been a focus of the coverage. So prior to the cessation of hostilities agreement between the that was brokered by the U.S. and Russia, there was a lot of coverage of the flight of thousands of civilians from Aleppo towards the Turkish border. And the fact that many of them were kept at zero point, so on the border itself, with the Turks kind of dispatching aid across the border into the refugee camps that were set up, hastily on the border. Now, there was a lot of criticism of Turkey's decision not to let in the refugees. In our conversations with Turkish officials, they've said that they expect hundreds of thousands of refugees to stream into Turkey from Aleppo if the fighting there continues and if the offensive that the regime has launched with Russian backing continues. And so as a result, they've said that we're going to let those people in if the crisis does reach that point, but prior to that we're fine with keeping them there. But obviously, the involvement of Russia kind of raises a lot of questions in the region about whether there's space to revise the traditional sort of alliance base in the region, where many of the Gulf states kind of relied on the United States for protection and for retaining some sort of buffer to expanding Iranian influence in the region. But as a consequence of the Russian involvement in the war and the fact that the U.S. is not really providing much aid to the rebels and to the opposition in general, there's been a lot of talk about Russia's resurgence in the region and whether other countries in the region are likely to pivot towards them and towards China rather than the U.S. as a consequence of the Russian intervention in Syria. So there are a lot of major geopolitical questions that are being raised as a consequence of Russia's intervention, in addition to lately the escalating humanitarian crisis in places like Aleppo.
And Reuters had a piece recently called Russia, Lavrov and Kerry discuss need to cooperate on Syrian ceasefire. The piece says Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry noted the need to deepen further Russian-American coordination on Syrian ceasefire in a phone call on Thursday. Lavrov also drew Kerry's attention to the need to end a, quote, Western anti-Russian media campaign, the ministry added. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we barely are covering what the Russians are really up to. And if they want to call that a media campaign, then that is more of the kind of disinformation they've been putting out since the day they started bombing. You know, the entire Russian campaign of bombing, and there have been hundreds of bombs a day, was based on the claim that they were bombing the Islamic State, the extremists. But in fact, as I mentioned earlier, they've been bombing civilians and caused hundreds and hundreds of casualties among civilians, and they've been bombing the Western-backed rebel forces, the moderate rebels, sometimes called the Free Syrian Army, and doing the work of the Assad regime, or picking up where the Assad regime left off. I mean, I can tell you this town of Khuraytin I mentioned earlier near Aleppo, the bombing began, it was about a month ago, just after midnight, and they started bombing the suburbs, and then they started bombing the center of the city where the English teacher that I had been talking to lived. And they basically not destroyed the entire city, but they've made it uninhabitable. And this is a city, this is a populated city. Now, it's true it's in a strategic location, but then again, half of any country is strategic when you look at where the roads are laid out. And it's near Aleppo. It does control the high ground on one of the roads near Aleppo. But nevertheless, it had a population of at least 30,000 plus probably as many IDPs, internally displaced, living there as well. And they all had to flee. And I wonder whether the Russian media even mentioned what happened to this town and countless others where they've been bombing. So anyway, that's on the so-called media campaign. We the media who should be covering this are barely able to do it. Because it took me days to find my interlocutor on this one town, and I could only write about one town, and there are dozens of places where this applies. Mm-hmm. I feel completely inadequate.
If I can just chime in for a second.
Sure.
About Aleppo specifically. So Aleppo is a bit dear to my heart because my girlfriend is from Aleppo, and her family is actually visiting us from the city right now. It's the horror stories that you hear are absolutely incredible, compared to, the sort of, let's say, sterile coverage of, so many thousands of people have been displaced or there's an ongoing campaign or airstrikes. When you actually hear the human stories of what's going on in the city, it's absolutely breathtaking just how brutal the war is, and then it manifests itself in little basic things, just the idea of taking a long hot shower is absolutely alien to them, the idea of having a cup of coffee in the morning, the idea of actually having enough electricity to be able to listen to traditional music like the music of artists like Feyruz and so on. Listening to them in the morning is an unparalleled pleasure for them, and it's it's a story that resonates all over Syria. We did a story last summer with a guy in the Yarmouk refugee camp south of Damascus, and he had been living in under the siege for roughly 3 years almost, and he had never left the camp until relatively recently, and he wrote this beautiful riff on the 40 Rules of Love, which by the Turkish author Elif Shafak, based on Rumi's 40 Rules of Love, and he wrote something called the 40 Rules of Siege, which describes what it's like living under siege, there's such beautiful expression in it that it's absolutely heartbreaking. For example, he'll say that you learn in a situation where there's a siege to walk as if you're walking on eggshells, because everything that you walk on could one day you might want to save it as food. So he would shy away from walking on grass or plants just in case he might need to eat them at some point in the future. So there are so many of these human stories that emerge when you sort of dig deeper into it. But I agree with Roy, it's really difficult to try and focus on those stories when there's so much of geopolitical import happening.
Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian based in Beirut, and Roy Gutman is former Middle East bureau chief with McClatchy. He is currently working as a freelance journalist based in Istanbul, and we're talking today about ongoing media coverage of the worst humanitarian crisis in modern history. And Karim, since you're talking about what people are facing in Syria, the UN brokered a two-week ceasefire between the warring factions in Syria, and it's supposed to end this weekend. Is that right?
Well, De Mistura, Stefan De Mistura, the UN envoy, said earlier this week that he didn't really envision a deadline necessarily for when the truce is supposed to end. So he says that it should be. He expects people to continue to respect it so long as the peace talks are ongoing. So right now it's unclear if it is going to be respected. There's certainly been sporadic violence all over the country, but it's been significantly reduced compared to its levels prior to the truce being negotiated. So it's really an open question right now, and breaking with it would be fatal to the peace talks at this point.
What has changed for Syrians on the ground as the result of the ceasefire?
Well, the amazing thing is that Syrians are out in the streets and protesting. They're out in the streets. This Friday was called the Friday of renewing the promise. Tajdid al-Ahd, where Syrians have been obviously at the start of the revolution. There was this tradition of going out on Fridays for major protests, and they would be named after a particular theme that they would choose. And what we see now is that there's, people are turning out to protest in the opposition held areas, demanding the overthrow of the government. So, they're trying to recreate and relive the promise of those early days of the revolution, and reminding people that the core demand of the people of Syria is the overthrow of the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And it's really a feat of extraordinary resilience, after so much destruction and so much civil fighting happening in the country. This is still the spirit that's predominant in those areas.
And Roy, what are your thoughts on the fact that the dominant narrative in the media has followed the UN, the U.S., and Russia's claims that the ceasefire has been working?
I have great doubts. I think, as Karim mentioned, we know of violations. We know of major violations. We know of about 2 days after this, or 1 day after the ceasefire was declared, the Russians bombed one town near between Hama and Homs provinces, something like 60 times in the first day and 70 times the second day. That was just one example. And it happened in many places, and they've also, and obviously regime forces and Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah, the various forces imported by the Iranians, which they are running, like the Iraqi Shia and the Hazara from Afghanistan, are repositioning themselves in preparation for an end to the ceasefire. There have been moves, especially in and around Aleppo, where they're ready to resume the fighting. And I think, we're in a lull right now. Obviously, it would be a far greater thing if that could last, and in fact, if you could reach peace. But the problem is that because the Russian bombing, when the Russians started last September, and they intervened in this very major way, in a very dishonest, deployment, because it was claimed to be for one thing and it was really for another. When it started, the regime was really off balance. It had just lost an entire province, Idlib. It had just lost Palmyra and the desert area bordering to Iraq. They were really in a huge disadvantage. The Russians have changed the battlefield, but because the Americans have not done anything to rebalance it and to compensate the rebel forces for what the Russians have done to them, everything's unbalanced right now. This is not a stable situation by any means. The Russians have really thrown put their fists down on the scale on one side of it and have changed it. You cannot have a ceasefire. You cannot have a real peace agreement when you have such an imbalance on the artificial imbalance on the battlefield imposed by an outside player. So that's why I think we have to watch it really like hawks. We have to watch the violations, and we have to watch the preparations like hawks. I mean, it would be a fantastic thing if peace could break out. I don't see how it's possible under the current circumstances.
Karim, what are your thoughts? Karim? We can't hear you.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So one, just to add one point to what Roy was saying is that, one area where the truce is definitely not working is in terms of humanitarian aid. Part of the cessation of hostilities agreement was to ensure that there are large-scale regular aid deliveries to besieged places in Syria. And we know, according to figures, collated by groups like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, there are, nearly 2 million people living in besieged areas, and the vast majority of them are besieged by the regime. And part of the cessation of hostilities agreement was that there will be aid provisions to those places. And what we've been told by humanitarian workers and people in those besieged areas is that, the situation is largely completely unchanged from when the agreement was signed. So that's definitely a violation of the terms of the deal, or at least the spirit of the deal. While we sort of talk about the larger geopolitical implications of of a deal between the U.S. and Russia in Syria, you know, people are still dying from starvation and people are still being forced to eat leaves and grass, you know, to survive. So that's in addition, obviously, to the points that Roy mentioned about the military violations by both the Russians and the government. And from the very beginning, it was really difficult to see how a deal like this could be sustainable, you know, simply because of its terms. I mean, the deal excludes the Nusra Front, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which is a terrorist group and is operating on the ground. But the fact is, the Nusra Front is operating across much of the territory of Syria where rebels are present, and they've allied themselves with, you know, various different rebel groups. And so, you know, by extension, any campaign that excludes the Nusra Front will, you know, ultimately result in fighting between the government and the rebels, which is what we're seeing in various parts of the country, such as in Latakia and in Aleppo.
Yesterday, Reuters reported that major powers close to the UN-brokered peace talks in Syria are discussing the possibility of a federal division of the country that would maintain its unity as a single state while granting broad autonomy to regional authorities. This is according to diplomats. The resumption of Geneva peace talks is coinciding with the fifth anniversary of this conflict, which descended into a civil war. It says that UN peace mediator Staffan de Mistura prepares to meet with delegations from the government and opposition. One of the ideas receiving serious attention at the moment is a possible federal division of Syria. Roy, what are your thoughts on this report from Reuters?
This is an outcome that the regime, the Assad regime, would probably be happy with because Assad knows that he doesn't have any support among Sunni, who are the vast majority of the population, and he really doesn't have much support among anybody, but he probably can count, if he can count on anybody, it's his own Alawite sect, who are in the western part of the country on the Mediterranean, later Latakia and other provinces. And so I think that it's a regime idea that the Russians have picked up and are peddling and pushing, in fact, basically, which is to break up Syria, or in the guise of a federal state, but actually it would be split up. I don't know where the Americans come down on these things. The American position is so hard to read on next to everything, but officially, at least, the Americans agree that there must be a unified state. And this is an example. Whereas the people who want to preserve the state, and they want to preserve the entire state, and they want to make it a civil state that is run on under rule of law, are the rebel forces, are the opposition to Assad. And my point earlier about how the battlefield has now become skewed by the Russian bombing is that it's the Russian bombing has in a way been directed towards supporting the regime's goal here, which is a breakup of the state. And whereas the majority of the population, I think, don't want to do anything of the kind. The truth is that you know people are not going to return. We're talking about refugees. And by the way, I have to salute you for even having this program. Refugees are not going to return if Assad's still in power, even if it's a federal state, because they won't trust any of the outcome. And by the way, in breaking up the state, you know, to break up a state is one of the most horrific things you can do in statecraft, because you have to have vast population movements, you have to have people giving up their ancestral homes, you have to have the unmixing of a very mixed society, and you have violence, and this is all to support Assad staying in power. I think this whole thing is a non-starter, but they're going to talk about it for the very simple reason that the battlefield, as it is now constituted, thanks to the Russians, is imbalanced, and the population of Syria is not being asked for their views.
And Roy, just briefly, we were sad to hear that McClatchy shut down five overseas bureaus. We have so many McClatchy reporters on. They shut down Beijing, Berlin, Istanbul, Mexico City, and Erbil, Iraq. And you are a former Middle East bureau chief for McClatchy. You're now freelancing. How has your reporting changed as a result of McClatchy shutting down these bureaus? And now you're freelancing.
Well, you know, you have freedom in some senses because you know, you're not reporting to one editor, and so, but you're reporting to multiple editors, and you have to find them in the first place. I mean, freelancing is a very tough thing to do.
Yeah.
I personally decided that when McClatchy was, you know, they gave us adequate notice of their plans. But I decided that that I'm working in the middle of one of the biggest stories of my lifetime, and maybe one of the most important of our time, maybe the most important of our time, where there's a possibility it could turn into, it could produce a world war. You know, the tensions are so high between different countries in the region. Plus, there's the humanitarian catastrophe, which desperately needs to be written about. And it just seemed to me that whether or not I could make it financially, and I'm still working on that, that it was better to stay on and try and keep at the major story and develop the different angles, find publications or somebody who will want my services, and scrounge until I make it succeed.
Hmm.
And I think it's you know, it's the journalistic impulse. You know, going back to what our friend was saying, Yang Jisheng, you know, you have the obligation as a journalist to try to stick with the story as long as people will let you, and to tell it in the fullest way possible, and to break news as it comes, or at least to tell a human story as well as you can. I couldn't see walking away from that, so that's why I'm still there.
Well, we're glad you're still reporting on these issues. And what about you, Karim? Has The Guardian made a commitment to continue running stories about the refugee crisis, specifically the human side of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're constantly being told to look for the human. I think it's you know, I've received a lot more positive responses, you know, to pitches of refugee stories. The challenge, obviously, is for us to you know, be able to find a way to make those stories you know, compassionate and allow people to relate to them. You know, I mean, we have a full time migration correspondent, Patrick Kingsley, and he's covering the issue for a long time. But you know, we're also doing a lot of coverage in Lebanon and in Turkey. You know, of the ongoing elements of the crisis. But I mean, you know, the thing I need to stress is that I mean, I feel the refugee story is the one that you know, really highlights for us, or you know, is most challenging because of you know, the story is not boring, but people have a sense that, you know, if you pitch a refugee story, you know, it's a tired it's going to be tired and cliched. But it can be so much more than that. I mean, I'll give you an example.
Actually, Karim, I'm so sorry, but we're out of time. But we're so happy to have both of you, and thank you so much for your reporting. Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian based in Beirut. Roy Gutman is former Middle East bureau chief for McClatchy, luckily still a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Emily's List founder, Ellen Malcolm. In her new book, When Women Win, Malcolm retraces recent history when women candidates were not taken seriously. For the last 30 years, Emily's List has aimed to change that. There are more women in politics today, but they still hold only 20% of the seats in the House and Senate. So why has progress been so slow? And what happens when more women get elected? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is KALW San Francisco. Coming up next, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller, followed by the Tavis Smiley Show at noon and Latino USA. All ahead here on KALW and at KALW.org. It's 11 o'clock.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, what's the secret to a better future?
So I think this new world where we can do six things at the same time has the potential to be a better and more delightful one.
And our smartphones help us manage our lives.
But that when it came to kids, text and voice and data weren't enough. You actually needed people. And if that person couldn't be you or a grandparent or a trusted family member or even a close friend, then who could it be?
Robin Chase, co-founder of Zipcar, and Sarah Scher, founder of Kango. That's today on Inflection Point. Stay tuned.